My goal in writing this book was twofold, to demystify Condoleezza Rice, and secondly, to try to explain what really happened at the highest levels of the Bush administration. But I really believe that you can't understand the last 7 years of the Bush administration without understanding her interaction specifically with the president.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our speaker today is Elizabeth Buemiller. Elizabeth Buemiller held from September 10th, 2001 until 2006, one of the most consequential jobs in American journalism. She was White House correspondent for the New York Times. She was born in Denmark, moved to Cincinnati when she was 3 years old, was educated at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. She began her newspaper career at the Washington Post. In 1983, she married Stephen Wiseman, who then was serving as White House correspondent for the New York Times. I wonder how many husband-wife tandems there have been over the years at the Times. Soon after they married, he became head of the Times Bureau in New Delhi, and Buemiller began her first book, May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, about life for women in India. When Wiseman became Tokyo bureau chief for the Times in 1989, Elizabeth Buemiller started a second book, The Secrets of Mariko, about Japanese women in Tokyo. When they returned to New York, she began to work for the Times and covered the Giuliani administration. And after her service as White House correspondent, she took leave to write a book about another woman, Condoleezza Rice. Her book is Condoleezza Rice, An American Life. Please welcome Elizabeth Buemiller.
Thank you all very much for being here in this beautiful setting. Thank you, George, for that great introduction. You can see that my husband and I have sort of traded jobs over the year. What George didn't say, because there's no reason he would have known it, is I was City Hall bureau chief for the New York Times, but my husband had held the same job 20 years earlier, so we're in this long pattern. And hello, Phil. I'm going to, Phil Zelica is here in the front row, and Phil is in my book, and I feel very self-conscious lecturing to you about Condoleezza Rice when he is here, but he can ask questions and object to things I say. Anyway, I'm going to talk for 27 minutes, I'm told, and then I want to take lots of questions. My goal in writing this book was twofold, to demystify Condoleezza Rice over her 53 years and she's an enigma to many people, and secondly, to try to explain what really happened at the highest levels of the Bush administration over the last 7 years. It is a story of many policy failures, some successes, and also of the intense human interactions that led to those failures and a few successes. But I really believe that you can't understand the last 7 years of the Bush administration without understanding Condoleezza Rice and her interaction specifically with the president. Overall, it's a soup-to-nuts biography. It's a personal voyage of a young black woman out of the segregated American South. And it's also a public journey through an extraordinary half century in the nation's history. That really was one of the reasons I was drawn to Condoleezza Rice, in addition to the fact that she's a woman, and I've been writing about women for most of my professional career, because it was those 50 years were a very rich palette to work on. Her story encompasses the civil rights movement, the Cold War, the breakup of the Warsaw Pact, the end of the Soviet Union, the culture wars of the 1980s and 1990s at Stanford, treacherous faculty politics at Stanford, which, believe me, since we're in a university setting, could fill a book in itself, Brahms, football, race, gender, presidential politics, national security, terrorism, fighting with Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, the future of American diplomacy, and American foreign policy. So it's a story about Condi Rice, but it's also, she was, even as a child, as a passive child, involved in the civil rights movement. And so to me, it was just a way to write about these 50 amazing years. The book is based on 10 lengthy interviews with Rice, 8 I conducted in 2006 and 2007, solely for the purposes of this book. They were 8 one-hour interviews in her office at the State Department. I also drew from 2 other interviews I had with her in 2003 for the New York Times for stories I did, for one long story I did for the New York Times about her working relationship with the president. Much of that material was not published, so there was a lot of rich detail in that. I also spoke to 150 other people, administration officials, foreign officials, Condi Rice's friends, her enemies, her critics, her supporters, and her family. But I have to emphasize here, this is a very sophisticated audience, but I have to emphasize, because I get asked this question all the time, this is not an authorized biography. I used to bristle when I was asked that question because I'm a journalist. But to me, authorized suggests that she worked on it with me, that she saw parts of it as it was being written, that she had a hand in it, and that's simply not the case. She cooperated with the book and that she sat still for interviews. But the first she saw of it, of anything of it, was shortly before Thanksgiving, this past Thanksgiving 2007, when I had my one copy from Random House. And I was getting agitated calls from the State Department. And I said, OK, you can have my one copy. So I took it over, and I gave it to them to give to her. And she took it to Camp David that weekend. And I haven't heard back since, so which is fine. I was kind of hoping they would denounce me, but. Anyway, and I just want to say it's a work of it's a very long work of journalism. What I did in this book was what I would have done for any other article in the New York Times, which is I interviewed the subject, but I interviewed lots of people around her. I looked at documents, I looked at books, I looked at the record, and I put it all together into this narrative. So it's no more authorized than a New York Times article would be authorized about somebody. So the story of Condoleezza Rice starts on a plantation in 19th century Alabama. Some of her ancestors were white, as is not uncommon. Not any kind of source of embarrassment for the family, but it's not something they talked about a lot. But it really begins. In 1954, when she was born in Birmingham, I talk a lot about her childhood in Birmingham when it was really the central front of the civil rights movement. Although Condi Rice grew up in a highly educated middle class family, both of her parents had college degrees. Her grandparents, several of them had college degrees, which was quite extraordinary. She had French lessons and ballet lessons and etiquette classes on Saturdays at the church. Her father was a minister as well as a high school guidance counselor. Her mother was a teacher. Mother was also a music teacher. She dressed beautifully. So although she grew up in this very cosseted middle class environment, one of two middle class neighborhoods in Birmingham at the time that were open to blacks for living there, she also grew up in a very, very violent city. And it was, although her parents tried very, very hard to protect her, by 1963, the year of fire in Birmingham, really, it was pretty hard to keep her unaware of what was going on. That was the year, as many of you remember, that Martin Luther King went to Birmingham and with some of his lieutenants staged the children's marches in the streets, and that's where we have the pictures of Bull Connor's police turning fire hoses on black children who were marching in the streets, unleashing police dogs on them. And that September 1963, one of Condi Rice's childhood playmates, Denise McNair, was one of four young black girls who was killed in the church bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church by the Ku Klux Klan. So at the age of 8, Condi Rice went to her first funeral, and it was the funeral of her playmate, Denise McNair, and it was quite an event of history, as it turned out. Martin Luther King delivered the eulogy. The church was overflowing. She remembers standing outside on the steps of the church holding her parents' hands because it was too crowded to go inside. She also remembers vaguely that there were pastel-colored coffins because they were for little girls. And from there, The family moved on, and partly because of the violence in Birmingham, they moved on to Denver, where Condi Rice's father had gotten a job as an administrator at the University of Denver. This is also a very important point in Condi Rice's life. It's not as well known as Birmingham and as later as her time at Stanford, but it's really crucial because at this point she meets Joseph Korbel, a professor at the University of Denver, international relations, a Czech refugee, who happens to be the father of Madeleine Albright, the only other woman Secretary of State. And it was really in his class, which she wandered into kind of by mistake, that she became transfixed by the Soviet Union. Until then, she had trained to be a concert pianist. The great hope of her family was that she would again be a concert pianist, and she'd spent from the age of 3 to the age of 17 preparing for it. But that summer when she was 17, she went out to the Aspen Music Festival and learned that there were 10, 11, and 12 year olds out there who could play on site what it had taken her a year to learn. So she decided, as she's often said, I didn't want to be the person who was playing the piano at Nordstrom's, and I had to do something else. So her parents said, you have to find a major. This was the spring of her junior year. We're not spending any more money for more years of college. And so almost in desperation, she wandered into this international relations class and became transfixed by Korbel's stories. And from then on decided to study the Soviet Union, which her father found bizarre. He said, black people don't do that. That's one of the things he said, but she moved on. Eventually, she became a professor of political science at Stanford, where she had, to put it mildly, a rather controversial tenure. By all accounts, and I've spoken to many of her students, she was a terrific professor, terrific teacher. She was very popular. She and her colleague, Chip Blacker, who's still out at Stanford, would run these simulations in their classes on an international relations. So one side would be the old Soviet Union, the other side would be the Americans, and by the morning they would have to agree to an arms deal of some sort. And the kids would get really into it, and she was very engaging lecture after, and there were lines out her office door for hours, for her office hours. She helped a lot of students, especially some young black women, one young black woman in particular with scholarships who needed money. And she won Stanford's highest teaching award in 1984. I say all that because when she became provost, it was a different story. And she was a surprise choice for provost. Gerhard Casper plucked her out of the professorial rank. She was depending on who you talk to, but what I think is that she was on no one's short list, and he plucked her out because for a number of reasons. But she quickly became the person who did a lot of the unpleasant tasks for Casper, including presiding over a lot of the budget cuts that started early on, which made her unpopular. But she also had serious entanglements with women minorities about affirmative action and tenure decisions. And there were a number of times when she did not side with women professors who had been denied tenure. So many times, in fact, and because of decisions, statements she made about affirmative action at Stanford, she said that there should be no affirmative action. There should be affirmative action at the time of hiring, but no affirmative action at the time of tenure. It's a very controversial statement. And as a result, the U.S. Department of Labor began an investigation that's still on, I believe it's still ongoing, it may be resolved, but it was ongoing while I was writing the book into potential discrimination at Stanford. But the end result was she was a very controversial provost, although she to this day has a complex view of affirmative action. But it was at Stanford where she first met George W. No, she, it was at Stanford she had her first extended meeting with George W. Bush through one of her mentors, George Shultz. And it was through Shultz and also through her, partly through the Bush family, that she made her first connection with the current president. And that bond was really sealed in the summer of 1998 when George Bush was thinking about running for president, then Governor George Bush, and Bush 41 invited Condi Rice, who I forgot to say in this narrative had been for 2 years the that president's Soviet expert in the National Security Council staff. But Bush 41 invited Condi Rice out to Kennebunkport for a long weekend in the summer of 98. And to me, the story has always been like a father passing on a favored advisor to the son, because in that long weekend, Bush 43, then Governor Bush, and Condi Rice fished. They worked out in the gym at Kennebunkport. They talked about foreign policy. And it was really at the end of that weekend that Bush 43 decided that Condi Rice would be his one of his chief foreign policy advisors in the campaign. Which brings us up to more or less the present day, which is more than the second half of the book. And in this, time slows down now because we're not hurtling through, 46 years. We're moving down. There's basically, it's a chapter a year now. And it's interesting, the argument I make about Condi Rice's national security advisor is that she in many ways was in an impossible situation. She came to the job with really only 2 years of mid-level White House experience, again from the Bush 41 days. Her job was coordinating the elephants in the room, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, who between the three of them, one was a war hero, had decades upon decades of White House experience and wartime experience. And so I think that she quickly saw that the source of her power would be her closeness to the president. And in that sense, she was right, and she aligned with the president. But I argue that I think that that closeness in many ways created problems for her and for the president and for the country. I think because of her closeness, she was reluctant to push the president in many cases, including on raising questions and about the Iraq war, airing dissenting opinions. And I also think, and I've heard this from people at the White House, that the president, because of his intense loyalty to Condi Rice and her affection for her, was reluctant to push her to do more of the job that he needed to do. And the result was in many ways a dysfunctional situation. What I found most interesting in some of my interviews was that we know that Condi Rice had a very bad relationship with Donald Rumsfeld. That's been well documented. What I found interesting was that she also had a very tense relationship with the vice president in this mix, which she actually talks about on the record, which I find extraordinary. From the very first days, Dick Cheney went to the president and said he wanted to run National Security Council meetings in the president's absence. Well, this was not just which is what happens when the president's not there. It's called a principals meeting, and usually the National Security Advisor runs it. This was not, but Cheney said he had wanted to have a strong role in foreign policy, proposed that he should be the one to do that. This was not just a bureaucratic turf battle. This was a man who wanted to wrest powerful control of foreign policy in the White House. Condi Rice got wind of this, went straight to the president and said, Mr. President, this is what national security advisors do. And the president sided with Condi Rice, but she learned from day one that Dick Cheney was going to be a very, very formidable force. Other examples, in 2002, when the president changed U.S. policy and made what we now refer to as his Rose Garden speech, where he said that he cast a vision of democracy in the Middle East, but said the U.S. would not deal with the Palestinian leadership until there was a change in leadership, until Yasser Arafat was gone. It was a very bold move on the part of the administration. Dick Cheney was opposed to that speech. Condi Rice had been a big part of it, but he was opposed to that speech on the very morning the president gave it. So he was not, he did not have the rosy vision that she did, and the president did to some extent on the Middle East. In the summer of 2002, one of my favorite anecdotes, when Cheney made the now infamous Iraq war speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Nashville, I remember it very well because I thought it was a slow day in August in the office, and we suddenly saw these words coming over the wire about what Cheney was saying, basically threatening war with Iraq, and it was quite astonishing. And the story led the paper the next day about the vice president going full force toward war with Iraq. Rice saw those words too, and in her telling, alerted the president and said, Mr. President, I think, she was in Texas with the president, Mr. President, I think that the vice president has boxed you in, and we need to we need to do something about this. Now, in her telling, she says the president told her, well, why don't you call Dick and tell him what he should say? And so Condi Rice says she called the vice president and said, maybe you could tone it down, and the vice president did in the next speech. Now, I should add that I find it, again, extraordinary that the sitting Secretary of State is talking on the record about this to a journalist. It tells me that she's, it tells me where she sees Cheney's standing in history right now. It also tells me that things were very bad in there. I should say I don't have Cheney's version of the story. I tried very hard, but he did not talk to me, did not cooperate, although one of his very close, a person very close to him has since called me and objected to a number of things in the book, and I said, well, I tried to talk to the vice president. The other thing, again, is she and the vice president really tangled over torture and it's certainly about the secret prisons. There's another moment in 2006 when Cheney is, when Condi Rice is Secretary of State. There's a meeting in the Situation Room and an NSC meeting, and there's a very tough exchange about closing down the secret prisons in Europe. Condi Rice wants to close them down. That's her recommendation. Cheney wants to keep them open. There's also a debate about closing Guantanamo. In the end, the president did close down the secret prisons, but as we all know, Guantanamo remains open. But again, there was a lot of antagonism about on that issue. I think people have asked me. So now she becomes Secretary of State, and I argue that things change, of course, in 2005 when Condi Rice became Secretary of State. In many ways, we see her trying to correct a lot of the problems that she was part of in the first term. Now, on one hand. And in many ways, we see her doing the kind of things that Colin Powell tried to do in the first term, but that he'd been thwarted on. Now, one reason for that is that the world changed, and the president saw that, along with Condi Rice, that the world, that the administration could no longer be seen as the world's warmonger. And so, what you see now is an attempt for a peace deal between the Palestinians and Israelis in the Middle East. You see more of an emphasis on diplomacy with Iran. You certainly see emphasis on diplomacy with North Korea, which I think is, if there's going to be any big success in the next year, that would be, I think, the most likely chances for success. And there has been some already. But I think in this case, Condi Rice's close relationship with the president has actually helped her a lot as Secretary of State. I think she's become, I think she saw that she had to change things because of the problems of the first term, but I also think she's become much more emboldened as Secretary of State. She sees herself as, as rightly so, as a cabinet member with her own policy and her own right. She saw herself as National Security Advisor, as essentially a super staff person who was carrying out the president's wishes, who had for a long felt she should not air views of her own, and so what we see now is a lot more assertiveness. She certainly pushed the president in the spring of 2006 into offering to talk to Iran, although with conditions that were so onerous that Iran had to stop enriching uranium that nothing has come of it yet. But I do know that was a months-long process of prodding the president slowly until she got him on board. Never got Cheney on board entirely, of course. And similarly with the Middle East. Phil can tell me I'm wrong, but I think last summer there was talk all over Washington that the president was not on board with making a new effort in the Middle East. And she certainly right now is credited by the Israelis and Palestinians with pushing him and telling him something had to be done and offering the scenario for that. And what we saw was the Middle East Peace Conference in Annapolis in November. Now, what comes of that, I don't know. There hasn't been a lot of progress at this point, and it's now February. We've got 10 months left. I suspect we'll see a flurry of activity at the final days of the administration, much like what we saw during the Clinton administration. But the president made his first trip to the Middle East, finally, earlier, just last month. He's going back in the spring. So this is something. People ask me, what is the future for Condi Rice? I was just asked, today's Tuesday, Monday. I was just asked on last week, and I was on Sunday on by Tim Russert, you know, is she going to be on the ticket for vice president? Well, you know, he said, it'd be great for your book. I said, yes, it'd be great for my book. But unfortunately, I just can't promote that idea because I just don't see it. I think she would be more interested in it than people think. She's quite political. One of the most surprising things about her is again, how political she is. She told a professor out at Denver as a graduate student that she was interested in running for the Senate from Colorado. This is back in the early 70s. She had a long conversation with Pete Wilson in 91 after Pete Wilson had just won the governorship of California, and he had left his Senate seat there, and he had the right to fill it, to appoint someone. He had a long talk with Condi Rice about it, and she was certainly on the short list. In the end, he decided, and I talked to him about this, that she didn't have what he called the fire in her belly to do it. She also decided that she knew she would have to run for re-election election in 2 years, and that she would have to raise $20 million in that period of time to do it, and that it was quite likely she would lose, which is in fact what happened to the guy who filled the seat. He was defeated by Dianne Feinstein. So in that sense, she was right. But she did think about it long and hard. There has been talk from her staff and from her that she would one day be interested in running for governor of California. Schwarzenegger is up in 2011. I don't know how realistic that is right now. I don't think she can bear to think about that right now. But and then there was talk to her a couple years ago that she would be a perfect on the GO, a good spot. She'd be in a good position to be in the to be on the GOP ticket as a vice presidential candidate. That talk has really died down. You don't hear it now. You do hear mention of a lot of white guys running with John McCain, who I've been covering the last couple of weeks. I think that on one hand, if you had an Obama-Hillary or Hillary-Obama or some version of, well, one of them will be on the ticket, we know, that she would certainly bring a lot of attention to the ticket for an initial period. But I do think that with McCain, it's an awful lot of Iraq war. I think that McCain has certainly managed at this point to make his support for the war work for him, but that's because he has been very critical of the way the war was managed. And Condi Rice was one of those who was in charge of managing the war at that period. She was in charge of, you know, coordinating national security policy in 2002 and 2003 when things went very, very badly. So I think she would be a large target for the Democrats, perhaps a bit too much of a target for the Republicans. And I also think that she doesn't balance out McCain. I mean, McCain has talked about how he doesn't understand economic policy. I just think it's too much foreign policy. But that's, everyone's been wrong about this election, so maybe I'm wrong. I think she'll go back to Stanford, to the Hoover Institute, and write books, and think about her future. And I think I'm at 11:32. I'll stop. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. The relationship between the President and the Secretary of State has been so important to both of them and really intimate on many levels. You start that by saying, in effect, that President Bush 41 bequeathed his favorite advisor to his son, and yet the son has rejected or at least not accepted so much of the other Bush 41 legacy. What was different about Condoleezza Rice? Why did Condoleezza Rice and George W. Bush develop such closeness and intimacy so quickly? It wasn't just the elliptical trainer. Was it?
Well, here's the answer. On a personal level, I think that first of all, the president was Bush 43 was transfixed by her. She's an extremely captivating, charismatic person up close. He had never met anybody like her before. She can talk about foreign policy in a way that's not condescending. Bear in mind, he had very little foreign policy experience. He'd traveled very little around the world. And here was this woman who could talk about it in a way that made him feel smart, frankly, who made him feel, you know, he was asking the right questions, and didn't condescend to him as some people did at the time. I also think, and also, you know, she could, frankly, it's sports, she could talk sports at the same time. I mean, she can talk football like no other woman he'd ever met, and it's real with her. I also think that in the president, Condi Rice saw somebody who she thought had very good instincts, but also she saw somebody who needed her much more than his father had, and that was a very powerful feeling. And also in the summer of 98, she was in the throes of some really bad times at Stanford. In term, you know, it was midst of bitter academic wars, fighting with the faculty, and here was this guy, anti-academic in a way, anti-intellectual certainly. Not, I'm not saying quite smart man, but anti-intellectual. And I think for her, he was a complete breath of fresh air. Not to mention that he was probably going to be the Republican nominee. Let's not forget that. Power is very enticing too. So, and I think since then, as National Security Advisor, she went along with the president on almost everything. I mean, there were some things where she would challenge him, but you know, she saw herself as a super staffer to the president. She said to me that she defined the job of National Security Advisor as translating the president's instincts into policy. So there's no reason he would have rejected her in any way. And also, they were pretty much in the same mindset. So they agreed on most things, I would say, including the war, of course.
A wonderful presentation. One quick mini question to build on that initial question, and then my real question. I always hate using up two, but let me do a mini, which is, there has been some allusion, and I confess I haven't read your book, My Oversight. There was some allusion to her having what I would perceive as being a kind of moral awakening around sort of post-9/11 and whether that's an element of the relationship with the president, for whom this really is a huge thing. That's sort of a side question. My primary question is whether she has her own awareness of the interesting aspects of her relationship as a black woman with older power, more sort of significant, I hate to do this, I don't live my life this way, but older significant white men who've clearly played a major role in her advancement. And is that something everybody sees after the fact? Because of course, everybody had, you know, if you're a black woman, everybody around you was an older white guy.
Right.
But is that something which, there was something quite interesting about that and about the kinds of men who would have played that role, starting with Professor Corbell, obviously Gerhard Casper, I mean, it's her, yeah. Bush Pair, kind of intriguing, and what's her own awareness of that?
You said something that I often say to this question, which is that, sure, her mentors have been powerful white men, powerful older white men all her life, but in her field, at the time, and even now, there aren't a lot of young black women to attach herself to, as you know. And so, in that sense, I feel like it's a little unfair. I mean, you didn't say it this way, but it's a little unfair to say she's always, you know, attach herself to powerful white men. Those are the people who had power in Washington, and you know, with Stanford and so forth. But I certainly hear you. I do. I mean, she does have an effect has an effect on men. She's extremely intelligent. She's extremely attractive. She engages people, you know, but I mean, so do a lot of younger men with older men. I mean, I don't want to make this into some sort of a thing, right? I'm careful about that. But the other question was about her mind. I think that's an interesting question because, you know, when you ask her, one of the most interesting things she said to me was when she, after the, you know, she had a very bad September 11th, 2001, needless to say, we all had a bad one, but hers was, she was in the, you know, bunker for most of the day, in the White House bunker with the vice president, and they thought they'd shot down a commercial airliner and that sort of thing. And that night she slept at the White House, in the White House residence, because the Secret Service says it's too dangerous to go home, and so she stays upstairs in a bedroom in the residence. And, you know, I talked to her about that. She's tossing and turning, she can't sleep, it's 1 a.m, she's sort of dully watching the TV news and not really comprehending. And I said to her, were you blaming yourself for anything that had happened that day? Because don't forget, she knew, although we didn't know at the time, what She'd been warned about, you know, all the, and she said, "I wasn't, not yet," which is the closest she came to acknowledging that there might be some blame. But later when I asked about blame and do you regret, and she said, "Look, you know, here's how you react to 9/11. You don't go around beating yourself up saying, you know, you just don't do that." She said, "What you do do is say, this is never going to happen again on our watch." And she said, "And that's why we, I don't know how she put it, she didn't say ran roughshod over civil liberties, but that's why you put all these controls in place. That's why." And I think what happened after 9/11 is, you know, every day the president, for the first time, the president of the United States got this threat matrix, this big stack of paper listing all the threats against the United States. They were looking at really, you know, piles of raw intelligence about threats against the United States. And people who've seen that say to me, you know, it changes your psychology. It's terrifying. And I think after 9/11, I'm not saying this is the reason they went to war in Iraq, but I think it's, you know, it was nothing was going to be left to chance anymore. And if there was the slightest danger as they perceived it, they couldn't let this happen again. And she does say it. She did say to me, "This really changes your psychology, having this happen once, you know. You overreacted. We overreact the next time, perhaps."
Hello. I believe at the time of the rumors of the secret prisons, that I recall Condoleezza Rice assuring the American public and Europe that the United States does not, did not, and will not torture. And now we know that those words were not true. Do you have any insight into Condoleezza Rice's viewpoint at that time?
Well, I think they still say that. The president still says we don't torture. It depends on what you define as torture. But absolutely, she, it was right after she became Secretary of State. No, it was December of 2005 when she went on that trip to Europe and took a lot of heat on that trip for the secret prisons. And then came back, and I think was one of those pushing to have them shut down. But I think that I think she would say that, you know, there's a different definition of torture. I can't really help you out there. I just know that she went on that trip, defended the practice, or took a lot of heat for it, and then came back, and I think tried to work behind the scenes to move it in a different direction. If that helps you at all.
You interviewed so many people for this book. I'd like to know if you interviewed Rumsfeld or Cheney, if you tried to and failed.
Yes, I tried to and failed. I tried very hard with Cheney. Rumsfeld said, "No, forget it." I tried very hard with Cheney. I did interview people close to them, though. I mean, I did interview people who presented their point of view and stuff. And I really tried with Cheney. I did not interview the president as well. I tried really hard with the president. And so that's missing. It would have been a better book with those interviews. But it's a tough administration in terms of talking to journalists.
Hi, thank you so much for filling out my understanding of Condoleezza Rice. But given the insight that I've gotten about her attempts at peacekeeping, I'm still kind of stuck on how she got so caught up, like General Powell, in the big lie about Iraq.
The big lie about Iraq. Yeah. Well, she believed it. I mean, I don't want to sit here and... I mean, she believed it. She would say, which they've said 1,000 times, that, you know, she believed the intelligence. And now, she was presented with some differing points of view on, for example, the aluminum tubes. There was a report from the Energy Department that questioned whether the aluminum tubes were, you know, of Saddam Hussein were going to be used for nuclear weapons. But she said she chose to believe the report from the CIA. That's what you do in her position. I mean, that's her answer to that. That, you know, but she certainly was presented with that different point of view. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I interviewed her as a sitting Secretary of State. I don't know if someday she'll write her own book saying how many mistakes were made in the first term and where we went wrong. And I don't know if she would say that was a mistake, not to take the differing reports more seriously. You know, that's what she says, though. And she also, you know, I don't think she thinks at all the war was a mistake. I mean, she has said, of course, that there were 1,000 mistakes made, which caused Donald Rumsfeld to go crazy one spring when she said that. But she certainly, in retrospect, did not agree with the way Rumsfeld managed the war. But she was not able to change that when she was National Security Advisor. In fact, one of the most striking things I learned was that she was having a difficult time just getting information out of Rumsfeld and the Pentagon in 2002 and 2003 during the run-up to the war. She had three people, you know, full-time on her staff who were in charge of ferreting out information from defense, so the National Security Advisor of the United States could see information about troop levels in the Gulf before we went to war. It's an extraordinary fact. You know, it's one of the things I write about in the book. There was a member of her staff who used to go over to the Pentagon, put on his uniform, pretend he was going to visit friends, and then would spirit out information from the Pentagon. She also had people who had security clearances from the Pentagon who were trolling through the computers to find her information. She doesn't deny this. Her answer to it is, well, that's just the Pentagon. Well, the answer is also that it was Rumsfeld's Pentagon.
Like to thank you for a very excellent talk about this very, very smart and stimulating woman. Would you elaborate a little more about where she might be going 7 months from now?
Well, as I said, I think she's going back to Stanford. She certainly has there's a spot there for her. They've kept it open for her, as they, you know, they've given her a very long leave of absence, as they do for cabinet members, not for everybody. And I think there'll be some protests there. There'll be some fussing. There'll be some protests from the students, and there'll be some consternation among the faculty. But the administration will welcome her. And I suspect she'll write a book. I don't know that she'll write a memoir. She said to me that she doesn't keep any notes. She doesn't talk into a tape recorder at the end of the day, although she does have, I think, some staff people taking notes. But she said, do you think that I really want to write down what I do every day at the end of the day, you know, sort of to relive this thing? I think she'll make speeches. I think she'll go on boards. She's often talked about getting involved in Silicon Valley and in business. And I think she might. I don't know enough about the politics of California right now to know how realistic it would be for her to entertain political office out there. I just don't know. But you should know she's always used Stanford as a fallback position. She's insisted after the first term that she was going back to Stanford and that she didn't want to be Secretary of State. She was not a diplomatic person. She often said that. And then, of course, you know, if the president asks, you tend to say yes. I mean, she claims she had had to think about it a while, but so I think that's where she is. I don't think it's the end of her. I don't think she's going off into the sunset. I think she's only 53. I think she'll be around for a long time in the public realm.
Yeah, very interesting talk. I would like you to go over her relationship with Colin Powell.
Oh, yes. Well, that is an interesting relationship. Depends on whether you talk to her or Colin Powell. Powell certainly felt undercut by her a number of times. I mean, they knew each other, had known each other from the Reagan administration. Powell was deputy national security advisor, and Condi Rice was a young fellow on leave from her professorship at Stanford and worked in the Pentagon for about 6 to 9 months, I believe. And she met Powell then. And she asked to meet Powell because Powell's wife, Alma, had grown up in Birmingham, and in a fancier family than Condi Rice grew up in. Alma Powell's father was the principal of the all-important Maine black high school in Birmingham during the civil rights days. And he's really, if you go to the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, he's there. He's a very important figure, was a very important figure in the black community. So she knew Powell. But, you know, Powell felt in the first term, but that was the only time they worked together in the Bush 43, that she was an unreliable ally. He felt that, and he told her so. He told her in the summer of 2003 that I don't know if he used the word dysfunctional, but that the NSC was not working. He felt that she was that Cheney was running roughshod over her, that Rumsfeld was running roughshod over her, that she was not adequately presenting the views of the State Department to the president. He felt that she sided with the Hawks when it was convenient for her and when she had to. But in retrospect, he now says he thinks he was a little hard on her because he felt that it was an untenable situation and the president had the national security advisor he wanted. So it's he also was totally exasperated about any notion that she, especially a couple years ago, that she would be running for president or being on the ticket as vice president. This aggravated him no end. He, by the way, was rumored a couple weeks ago to be on the ticket with McCain, but that was completely shot down.
I'm interested in what you learned about the way the president operated on a day-to-day basis in view of these warring factions within his administration. And it seems to me that he operated on sort of high moral level, the spread of democracy and so forth, which she had derided just a few years before, but bought into. But if he has all of these people squabbling with one another, does he simply delegate to her the business of getting them all together, or doesn't he go to talk to them, or doesn't she go to talk to him and say, won't you do something about this?
Well, that's a really good question. Someday we'll know more about what really happened. I mean, whether she went to him and said this is untenable on Rumsfeld or he told her to get control of this, we have anecdotal evidence here and there. But I think it's fair to say that the for the president, for all of the talk of him being being an executive, you know, this was an executive business-like administration. There didn't seem to be any kind of cohesion in making decisions. A lot of times, you know, people would think a decision had been made and nothing would happen. There'd be no follow-through. I heard that a lot. You know, there'd be National Security Council meetings. Everyone would make their presentation. And then everybody would go away and nothing would get decided and nothing would get done. Other times, Cheney and Rumsfeld would, I mean, other times Cheney would, there's an example on, but there were other times when Cheney would go directly to the president, go into the Oval Office, get a decision and walk out, and it would be announced to nobody, and Condi Rice would find out in the press what had happened. You know, so there was a lot of ad hoc, and the president would say, well, you know, I really want my advisors to air all their differing views. I want to have, you know, that was how he would explain it, or how Andy Card, the White House Chief of Staff at the time, would explain it. We want to have differing views. But it really was kind of a free-form situation many times.
You discussed how ambitious she is and how much that influences how she acts. I'm wondering how much you think it influenced how she acted perhaps at Stanford when she was deciding against the women faculty and also perhaps also as National Security Advisor.
Well, good question. First of all, I want to say I have no issue with a woman being ambitious. I hate that when you didn't mean to say it this way, but I don't want to. It's okay for a woman to be ambitious. It's all right. You know, I think when people criticize Hillary Clinton, she's so ambitious. Well, duh. You know, I mean, she's running for president. So, you know, so is Barack Obama. So I just want to make that clear. Secondly, I think that at Stanford, to give her the benefit of a doubt, she really believed that she to this day has this absolutely emphatic view about affirmative action in a university, and she really believed that there should be affirmative action considered at the time of tenure. In other words, I'm trying to explain this complicated view. In other words, when you're hiring a young professor, you know, open the gates and consider all people, and you know, if you know, including you know, a young black woman, you know, take a chance, and then you've got that young woman has 7 years to prove herself before she 6 to 7 7 years before she comes up for tenure. At that point, you know who she is, you know her work, you know what she's published, you know how she teaches, and at that point, there should be no consideration for affirmative action because she's had 7 years. Okay. And Condi Rice has said, that so there was no affirmative action in consideration at the time of her tenure decision at Stanford. What the women of faculty argued was that, there was affirmative action considered for Condi Rice, although nobody knows the secret deliberations of the tenure committee. And but they also said that that there were many cases. There were specific cases that they felt were particularly egregious where women had published and were denied tenure. But it's very, I could get into these endless details and I won't. I think what surprised me about her was I think she took a really tough line on them because she believed it. She believed that, I came up myself and here are all these women, I was black and a woman in the South during segregation, and here are these women of a different generation. We were in the first wave of feminists and who were whining, in her view, whining about treatment at the university, and give me a break was kind of what she would have said. They think they've had it tough. They don't know what they're talking about. I went through all this. I mean, she didn't articulate this to me, but that is what I think was going on there. What I do think is odd, I think she'd be different now, is that why she took such a tough line against these women, why she just didn't acknowledge the problem, which there was at Stanford. If you look at the tenure rates for women faculty at 25 elite institutions, and I found these statistics from a group that tracks this, Stanford was at the absolute bottom of this list in terms of tenure rates. It was at the bottom with Harvard and Yale, I might point out. So it had some good company, but it was hardly a good record. So I don't understand why she didn't acknowledge the problem and then say, come and join a committee and work on it together and just try to diffuse it. Rather, why she confronted them so publicly is what I just found odd.
Thanks for your presentation. You mentioned that when she was National Security Advisor, that she saw her job as translating the president's instincts into policy. I wonder if your interviews with her, whether you got any sense of whether the president had some sort of coherent view, a set of instincts about foreign policy and the position of the country in the world.
Well, sure. I mean, she certainly saw that. I mean, she talked most, the most we talked about that was actually in the interviews I had with her for this story in the Times, because she talked a lot about how the president arrived at this kernel of an idea about how there could be democracy in the Middle East, and wouldn't it be great if democracy could flourish in the West Bank and so forth, and so I remember talking to the president about Natan Sharansky, and he was very affected by that book about democracy, and so that was a broad vision of the president that she thought she tried again translate into policy, into what became the Rose Garden speech in 2002. Certainly on terrorism, you're with us or against us, and countries who harbor terrorists will be as guilty as, those are all visions of the president. The president had, you don't hear so much about democracy anymore. They've kind of become more realistic. But he, I think also, I want to be careful here on AIDS in Africa, I think, too. I think she was very influential on the president. She and Colin Powell were very influential on the president on AIDS and getting money for AIDS. And you certainly see that this week when the president's traveling in Africa. And that's one thing where she did take a lot of credit and say that wouldn't have happened without me pushing for that and for Colin Powell.
African Americans have not been prominent in national security or the conduct of foreign policy until really Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, with the possible exception of Ralph Bunche many years ago. Do you think that the candidacy of Barack Obama would be possible without Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice?
Would it be possible without them? No, I think I don't think it has that much to. I don't know that it has that much to do with them. I think he's kind of this candidate who sort of transcends a lot of race considerations. But I do think that, you know, he's got a young, very young African-American woman named Susan Rice, who's one of his chief foreign policy advisors. So I think there's a prospect that if he became president, that we'd have another Rice as national security, you know, another. They're not related, I don't think they're particularly fans of each other's policies, but they do know each other. They've met each other.
Thank you very much for an important talk about a consequential person.
Thank you.